Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
This is BBC Radio.
Six music. Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Roger Daltrey.
Everett, and welcome to The First Time here on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. My guest this week, well, he's the voice of one of the greatest rock bands of all time, a band whose members included a songwriter who helped make pop music into pop art, and a bass player and a drummer who played their instruments like lead soloists, and his voice. A staggeringly powerful and unique combination of passion and soul. A voice you could have first heard in the mod clubs of West London, then the Marquee, then to festivals like Monterey and Woodstock, and then to arenas and stadiums across the world, all the way to the present day. My guest on The First Time this week is Roger Daltrey. In the wake of Roger releasing his latest solo album, As Long As I Have You, which taps into his earliest passions for soul and R&B, here we discuss the music that made him want to start singing, Johnny Cash, Chuck Berry and Sonny Boy Williamson, and we look back at the very birth of The Who. We also talk about The Who's artistic evolution as they started to expand their songs and ambitions to encompass the idea of concepts and even rock operas like Tommy, and how that wasn't always an easy thing for him to deliver as a vocalist. Roger also discusses his experiences of being in a band with Keith Moon and his plans for producing a film of his life. And we also talk about the Teenage Cancer Trust, the charity he's been a patron of since 2000, and the incredible work that they do. But I started by asking Roger, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
I can remember before I was 5 years old listening to the radio. Mum used to have the radio on all day, and in those days it was things like Workers' Place Home and Housewife's Choice and all those things. And most of the music was big band, kind of 40s Glenn Miller type music. And then the first time I got really interested in music, apart from singing in the church choir, and kind of music grabbed my ear big time, was my uncle started playing me some Hank Williams. That kind of, I went, oh, this is different.
I wondered so aimless, life filled with sin. I wouldn't let my dear Savior in. Then Jesus came like a stranger in the night. Praise the Lord,
Then, of course, it went on to Little Richard and Elvis and Lonnie Donegan and those people. They were the ones who inspired me.
Now I'll tell you where I'm going, boy. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride, yes. The Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you own to ride, you got to ride it like you finally get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. And maybe right.
We get this idea that Skiffle just, like, swept the whole nation. Was it really like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what that was the difference between Lonnie and Elvis. Elvis, we all wanted to be Elvis, and we all wanted to look like Elvis. Of course, none of us did. But when Lonnie popped his head above the parapet, he wasn't dressed cool. He used to wear a dinner jacket and a bow tie. But it was the way he sang and the music he played was so kind of primal. They were all just early American folk songs, lead belly songs and things like that. But the way Lonnie used to sing them, he used to throw his head back and wail. It kind of just released something in the youth of the time where they thought, I can do that. You know, it was almost like lighting a touch paper. Every street had at least one skiffle group.
Really?
All playing the same songs, making the same racket on various homemade instruments. But it was just an amazing time, really amazing time.
What was the first single you owned? The first bit of music that was yours?
Oh, God, I can't remember. I really can't remember. I think it was probably... It might have been Eddie Cochran. I didn't used to buy much because we didn't have much money.
Mm.
But it might have been Buddy Holly or Eddie Cochran. One of those two. I can't remember.
You mentioned Chuck Berry. Is there a Chuck Berry track? What was it about him that kind of...
Oh, just his lyrics. I mean, he was the penultimate lyricist. I mean, where he didn't have a word, he'd invent a word, you know. As I was motivating. I mean, and it's just wonderful language. He was so ahead of his time, Chuck. Just, again, there's something just primal in that music, the way it comes across. And that's what I love about early rock. Well, rock and roll, that is. It's got that primal quality.
As I was motivating... Back in town, I saw a Cadillac sign say, no money down. So I eased on my brakes, and I pulled in the drive. Gunned my motor twice, then I walked inside. Dealer came to me, said, trade in your Ford, and I'll put you in a car that'll eat up the road. Just tell me what you want. Then sign that line, and I'll have it brought down to you in an hour's time. I'm gonna get me a car, and I'll be headed on down the road. Then I won't have to worry about that broken down ragged boy. Well, mister, I want a yellow convertible. DeVille, with a Continental spare and a Y-chrome wheel. I want power steering and power brakes. I want a powerful motor with a jet off take. I want air conditioned. I want automatic heat. And I want a full Murphy bed in my back seat. I want shortwave radio. I want TV and a phone. You know I gotta talk to my baby when I'm riding alone. I want four carburetors and two straight exhausts. I'm burning aviation fuel, no matter what they cost. I want railroad air horns and a military spot. And I want a 5-year guarantee on everything I got. I want $10 deductible. I want $20 notes. I want $30,000 liability. That's all she wrote. I don't know.
When did you first realise you could sing? When did you think, I've got an instrument here?
Oh, I sang in the church choir when I was about seven, and I had a really good voice. But when did I know I could rock sing? I don't know. I've never really liked my voice.
What?
No, I think it's quite common to all singers where they, you know, and people indeed that work on like in radio, for instance.
It's true.
Do you like yourself when you hear yourself?
No, I can't stand it.
No, you can't. I mean, it's something about the way we hear ourselves in our head, and then when we hear ourselves through a speaker, it's not me, and I go, ooh, I don't like it, and it's weird.
Really, on those records, you're kind of like, who's that bloke?
Yeah, I've kind of come to terms with it now, but I do know when I'm doing something right. I do know when I'm doing something, you know, getting something across, and it's nothing to do necessarily with the sound, but to do with the vibration and the emotion.
Mm. Another first I wanted to ask you about, first harmonica player that you were like, they're good, I want to be like them.
That would have been Sonny Boy Williamson.
Right.
And that was at the Marquee, when we used to play the Marquee every Tuesday night, way back in 1964, and Sonny Boy occasionally would come up and play with us. And
what?
Wow, yeah, he was... He was incredible. He was truly incredible. He used to have hardly any teeth in his top jaw, and very, very few in the bottom one. He could make that harmonica sing like no one else. He could make it warble. And not only could he do it while he was holding the thing and make all those sounds, Sonny Boy could... You'd be standing backstage kind of listening to this stuff going on and watching him, because he was such a cool guy. And all of a sudden, the harmonica would be wailing, and he'd bring his hands up out to the side with no harmonica. And you realise it, and he'd go around the front and have a look, and he's got it stuck in his mouth like a sausage. And he's still able to make it wail. You know, how he did it, I don't know. And he used to kind of hold it with his tongue. It was extraordinary what he could do with that instrument. And he was such a sharp guy. He used to have one suit, which was kind of chocolatey brown. It had been ironed so many times, you could see your face in it. And he'd have his briefcase with his harmonicas in it, you know, and a bottle of whiskey and a bowler hat. And, of course, he'd come up all humble and, can I play a song with you? And he'd be worshipping, it was like seeing God for us.
Your woman, I wish to God, man, that you could see mine. You talking about your woman, I wish to God that you could see mine. Every time the little girl starts to love me, she bring eyesight to the blind. Thought her daddy must been a millionaire, I can tell by the way she walks. Her daddy must have been a millionaire, because I can tell by the way she walks. Every time she started loving, she deep and down began to talk. I remember one Friday morning we were lying down across the bed. Lord, ain't she pretty? And the whole state knows she's fine. Every time she starts to love him, she bring eyesight to the blind.
His soul has always been close to your heart. You've always loved soul music. I mean, Etta James is one of your loves, and it's reflected on this new record. And it's really interesting seeing so many of those early Who tracks are like R&B covers, and they're soul covers.
Yeah, we used to play James Brown songs.
Yeah.
You know, we all kinds of stuff. Arthur Alexander. We we did a Garnet Mims song, but I can't remember whether it was this one, As Long As I Have You. I don't think it was. But, of course, in those days, you sing the melody and you sing the words, and that was one thing. But there's something about soul that you need to do a lot of living, and you need to put a lot of life on your under your belt to sing it properly, you know.
If you're 19... You haven't quite got the soul
Not
yet.
Not quite. You know, it's kind of more of a mimic than the real deal, isn't it? You know.
But you did it well.
We did it all right. I mean, I was James Brown. I could do well. I could really lose myself in that. And we used to do the version of Please Please, and there were some quite really good recorded versions of that. I used to do Howlin' Wolf and all that blues stuff, but that was more mimicking because our voices weren't like their voices, but you want it to be. but now you just use the voice you've got and you don't care about the sound. The sound is the sound it is.
Looking at those first Who gigs, the early Who gigs, and they've been documented a lot, but there's this, you all seem so confident. It was like, we are the right blokes in the right band at the right time with the right songs. And you see, because for that age, you see the footage and you're like, totally, we own this stage straight away.
Yeah, we were all right on the stage. When we got off the stage, there was lots of problems. We were very insecure. But I was off the stage. The stage, I was always comfortable. I don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, what's that come from?
I don't know. I've always been a firm believer that a group is always a better device for creating music than solo artists. I think, you know, when you look at the great solo artists, they get a good band, they keep them, and it becomes a group in the end, you know. So The Who was always my band. I was the founder member, then John came, Pete came, and then it kind of worked okay, but then when Keith joined, it was like we'd added a jet engine to an old prop biplane. That's what it was like. It really was. I mean, we played a version of Bo Diddley's Roadrunner, and Moon started to do drum beats that weren't there and kick up the tempo, and it became something else completely. And I knew that this was something magical happening.
Apologies mean nothing when the damage is done. But you
Johnny Cash. When did you first fall in love with the music of Johnny Cash?
That came from working in a sheet metal work factory where we weren't allowed to have a radio. And of course, to get over the boredom of just the non-stop cutting, banging and the noises of a factory, this very small factory in South Acton, a kind of asbestos shed, really. But there were guillotines going clang and presses going pum. And so, and hammers going and all kinds of noises. And we'd get a rhythm going and we'd sing all these songs all day. All the guys, they all just come up, a lot of them just come back from the war in Korea and the war in Malaysia. People forget about that war. So they were kind of, I don't know whether they were shell-shocked or what, but they used to love to sing. So, and then, I can't remember who it was, but someone, I think it was my mate Clive, he brought in this Johnny Cash record and he played it to me. I think we were papering his front room because he just got married. I kind of think that's what it was. And he played me this Johnny Cash record and I was completely taken by it because it had this rhythm. And so then we start banging in the rhythms. I tell you what, that governor was so sorry he never bought us a radio because we must have driven him mad. Because we used to sing at the top of our voices and once everything started banging in a rhythm, it could drive you nuts if you weren't involved in it.
What's the Johnny Cash song we should play?
Oh, we used to do them all. So, I mean, what do you want to play? Walk the Line is the classic. It's a classic Johnny Cash because it's the way he changes key after every verse. It's a very, very clever. And it sounds like he's going higher sometimes, but he's actually going lower. And vice versa. It's kind of cool, dude.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day is through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line. As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night. And happiness I've known proves that it's right. Because you're mine, I walk the line. You've got a way to keep me on your side. You give me cause for love that I can't hide. For you I know I'd even try to turn the tide. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. You better not bend over there with that camera like that. Man, you're in the wrong place to bend over, don't you know it? Get up from there with that camera. All right. All right.
BBC Radio 6.
Music.
Even from the second Who album, a quick one, in 1966, The Who were really experimenting. I mean, that record has got like a mini rock opera on it. I mean, it's, you know, it wasn't long before you were leaving R&B kind of behind.
I was very comfortable with it up until my generation. But then that period after that, the I'm a Boy, Pictures of Lily, Happy Jack period, was a very strange period for me.
Really?
Yeah, it's very, very strange because it was so unsoul-y. you know, it was so poppy. I had a very big quite a lot of psychological trauma going on. How do I get this across? Mm. But now I listen back to it, it's kind of interesting because my voice sounds haunted. And I was haunted. I was haunted by this. How do I sing this? Really, is this true?
Happy Jack wasn't old, but he was a man. He lived in the sand at the Isle of Man. The kids would all sing, he would take a wrong key. So they rode on his head in their furry donkey. The kids come to Jack, they drive. They drop things on his back. They couldn't stop Jack, all the water's coming. And they couldn't prevent Jack from being happy. But they couldn't stop Jack or the water slapping. Then they couldn't prevent Jack from.
That was the still completely bananas Happy Jack by The Who from 1966. And this is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest from The Who, Roger Daltrey.
Six Music. BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music. We'll be right back.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is from The Who, Roger Daltrey. And that was Won't Get Fooled Again. All of it. The whole glorious 8 minutes and 31 seconds of it. There was no way we weren't going to play it, and there was no way we were going to edit it. Anyway, so The Who were always a band looking to do something different and thematically expand what you could do with a rock song. The culmination of this would be the rock opera Tommy and the concept album Quadrophenia. But the roots of this can be felt all the way back to their second record in 1966. Looking at how The Who evolved, and there's the point around A Quick One, where you can see this idea of the 3.5 minute song. Okay, we're going to stop doing that. We're going to start pushing it out and making it broader. And it was really ambitious stuff.
Yeah, a lot of that was pushed on us by Kit Lambert, whose dad was Constant Lambert, the composer and one of the founders of Sadler's Wells Ballet Company. And because Kit he loved rock music and he loved pop music, and he loved the pop single, the 3 minute single. He said, "But this can add up to something much more. You know, it deserves a rock opera. This music is that good. It deserves more than we're doing with it." And he encouraged us, especially Pete, because he was the writer, to write longer and longer pieces with a narrative.
Yeah,
and we did things like Rael. And we was kind of almost, Pete would have a rough idea sketch of a thing, and we'd go in and we keep just adding harmonies, and we'd invent harmonies where some of those things had sort of 4-part harmonies. Incredible stuff going on. But it all kind of came out of the air. You know, the root of the song, the top line was there, and then we just keep adding and that. Like I Can See for Miles, for instance, just overdubbing, with more and more layers of vocal.
By the time that Tommy comes along, you as a singer, technically you're starting to push what you can do in terms of the way you occupy the song. By that point, you've just, you know, you kind of spread your wings.
Yeah, well, that came from the stage experience of performing Tommy. For the first time you're into a piece of music for a length of time.
Yeah.
So you immerse yourself into it like an actor, you know, immerses himself into a part in a play. So that's really where I found my feet as a singer.
I'm free. I'm free.
Do you remember your first big royalty check? What did you spend it on?
Our first big royalty check, we didn't have anything till about 19... We had existence money, which we paid the rent and we could have a flash car on HP. But the first money didn't arrive till 1971.
Because, yeah, this is the legend that actually it took ages.
Oh, ages. I mean, like, as Keith Richards said, it's a great life lesson. You know, and it happened to all of us. We all got robbed blind for a while. But then 1971, we did get a lump of money. First thing I did was buy Mum a house.
Yes.
As everybody did.
Yes.
Every working class kid did.
Good. What was the house like? Did you love it?
It was a house we grew up in Chiswick. I lived there from the age of 11. I moved from Shepherd's Bush to Chiswick. And then, and I've still got that today because, for me, it's a shrine to The Who, because that's where we used to, you know, push her bed up against the wall and put the drum kit up. And Moon set his drums up, and that's where The Who started. And the neighbours were so thankful that I'd given up the bugle. They could put up with the racket that Moon was making.
I mean, do you think with The Who, sometimes at the time, the kind of reputation of the band and hotels, smashing all that stuff, got in the way of how creative they were? Because if you listen to something like Quadrophenia, you were like 28 when you did that. And it's a hell of a piece of work, isn't it?
Oh, it's a magnificent piece of work.
Yeah, for you and Pete, both 28, under 30... to be writing such a beautifully composed, ambitious piece of music. Were you at a time, yeah, we smash rooms, yeah, shut up about that. Was that hard?
No, I mean, you have to treat the press. I mean, you've got to remember, in the end, the public loves they love the wrestling. And that's all it is. It's rock wrestling, I call it. You know, it's incredibly necessary because it keeps, you know, nobody's interested. Oh, this is a magnificent piece of work. You know, not really interested in that, but they are interested. Oh, do you see what they did last night? They smashed this up. It's a nonsense, I know. It's a creative, or destructive nonsense. But there you go. That's what it is. It's rock wrestling.
As it got to the scale it got, what kept you sane? Or as you seem to...
I don't know whether I am sane. Every year that goes by, I think I'm more insane.
The height of that, the big international fame when it first hit, not everybody makes it through that.
It was hard. It wasn't easy because a lot of the time I felt totally out of my depth, especially when Tommy hit as a film and I was the guy who played Tommy, and all kinds of fame, the ramifications of fame came down on me that didn't exist prior to that. Though we were an enormous band, we were probably the biggest band in the world at the time.
What sort of
film? Film, all of a sudden I'm being recognised by everybody and life became hell. And I didn't know how to deal with it. And I was like a fish out of water. I couldn't. And I did my best, but I decided I didn't like it much. I really didn't. Believe it or not. I'm not very good at the red... I still find the red carpet stuff very uncomfortable.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why. Always have. I'm quite shy, really. You know, it's kind of... It's like putting on a front, isn't it? It's like, you know, get a grip.
But we can put you on stage at Monterey, and that's fine.
Yeah, well, because we're with the band and you're in the music and you know the music you do and you're comfortable in that arena. Mm. That's what you do. But all the other arenas, that's what film stars do. And I wasn't good at, you know, I didn't want to be that kind of film star. I just wanted to be me, really.
Hey!
One of the kind of myths is that after Keith died, it was Pete that wanted to carry on, and you were like, I don't want to do this. Is that true?
No, that's not true.
That's not true?
No,
okay.
Not true. No. No, we both wanted to carry on. You know, we had a conversation, and I said, you know, in the end, Pete, the music will carry. We were in it. We were always in it for the music.
Right.
We can't bring him back, but the music we've created already can still echo, and the echoes of Moon will always be in that music. And so we should carry on, and who knows what will come. And then, let's be honest, quite a lot did come.
Because you said it was the lack of touring that was one of the reasons.
It didn't help Moon's condition, yeah. That's for sure, because drummers, they're like singers. Singers need to sing. If you stop singing, you lose your voice. Simple as that. It's only a muscle. If you stop exercising it, it will go. And it was the same for drummers. I mean, all that physical energy that it took. In those days, we used to be doing 2.5, 3-hour shows. You know, what was Moon expected to do with that energy if he weren't thrashing it out on the drum kit? And, of course, he took to all his, you know, pills and booze and all that stuff, and it was a one-way journey for him then. He did try and get himself back together, but anyway, that's going to be another story that I'll tell when I make my Keith Moon film.
Which I want to ask you about. Yes, is this still...
Very much so.
Right.
It's got to find the right screenplay. And at the moment, we have got a writer in place. I won't mention his name, but he's a very good writer. He hopes to be starting it towards the end of this year. Hopefully, we'll be in production next year. I've got to find a Keith Moon. It's going to be very, very dependent on the actor and the actor's eyes, because you've got to cast it completely from the eyes, because Moon and eyes, like, they're extraordinary eyes.
It's a tough thing to do, that, getting an actor to play a musician with that charisma.
What makes you think Keith was a f***ing musician? How dare you? He would have said, how dare me? How dare you, my boy? A musician? I'm a f***ing Keith Moon drummer. But they didn't really know Keith, and I don't know whether anybody outside the band really got to know him like we did. He was a strange bunch of people.
Let's do a good positive first. The first Teenage Cancer Trust gig, which was 2000.
Wow, yeah. So long time ago.
Yeah, so you had...
Long, long time ago. It's a song, isn't it? Yeah.
Noel Gallagher, Eddie Vedder, you guys. I mean, that moment when you thought, this is working, and maybe we could do another one? And look at us now.
Well, it was only... It wasn't... There was a moment that came 9 months after the gig.
Right.
When we got the first royalty checks, the charity got the money, because we did all that, and all the money in those days, there was a DVD market. There was a live record market. So we gave it all to the charity, all the rights to everything. And when they got their first checks, it was like an enormous amount of money. I mean, I think in the end they made about 4 million quid out of those two gigs. Maybe more in the fullness of time. But it was only then that I suddenly realised that what it had done, what the shows had done, it had made people aware of the position teenagers are in within the hospital system when they get something like cancer, which they get more than you would like, more than most people think. And of course, it's a horrible position, because you're either, if you're under 18, you're stuck in a children's ward, and over 18, you're stuck in with a lot of old farts like me. So that's completely, in my mind, unacceptable in today's day and age, when we understand totally how different adolescents and young adults are than either age group. But we're doing it slowly but surely. This is a foot in the door. People do not quite understand how much we do. They think they walk into our units in the National Health Hospitals, and they think because it's part of the hospital, it's part of the National Health. We are not. It is all funded. The whole bit of the building is funded by the charity, and we have to go out and raise that money every year.
How much have you raised?
I don't know. I don't.
It's
well, since we started you can't gauge anything by what the shows gauge. I mean, that's something like 25, 26, 27. million, but that's irrelevant. It's what the shows did, making the public aware of the charity and what we were trying to achieve. And the great British public, to their credit, recognise that this is something that needs to be done.
Born in darkness, but I fought my way up to the sun.
And there's a new album, As Long As I Have You, which kind of echoes your last record, Going Home, which was the one you did with Wilco Johnson. There's a kind of similar rawness and an intimacy on both those records.
Yeah, no, this is the music I wanted to... This is the album I wanted to do for a long time. These are songs that I've lived with for a long time. And I wanted to make a record that touched people. And I've got nothing to prove anymore, you know. At my age and this long in the business, what have I got to prove? But I wanted to touch people and move people with the words and the music. And I like the album. That's unusual.
The voice is still there, you know. You've still got that capacity. That power is still there.
It's my energy. It's my life force. That's what it is. If I ever was anything, I was a voice.
But it is quite a remarkable instrument.
Thank you.
What's the last song we should play? Your choice.
Oh, God. I don't know. Oh, God, you choose it. There's too many. Too many. Play Buddy Holly. That'll be the day.
Why that song?
It's just got a magical sound. Magical sound. You've got no idea what it was like to hear that sound. How are they making that noise? Yeah, it's incredible to hear it.
It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you very much, mate. Thank you.
All right, Matt, good to see you.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirt of loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you know you love me, baby. You tell me maybe that someday will I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day when I die. Heart. So if we ever part, then I leave you. You sit and hold me and you tell me boldly that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well,
this is BBC Radio 6 Music.
I loved you in the morning, our kisses deep and warm, your hair upon the pillow like a sleepy golden star. Yes, many love before us. I know that we are not new in city and in forest. They smiled like me and you, but now it's come to distances and both of us must try. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye. I'm not looking for another as I wander in my time. Walk me to the corner, our steps will always rhyme. You know my love goes with you as your love stays with me. It's just the way it changes like the shoreline and the sea. But let's not talk of love or chains and things we can't untie. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye. Morning, our kisses deep and warm. Your head on the pillow like a sleepy golden storm. Yes, many love before us. I know that we are not new in city and in forest. They smiled like me and you, but let's not talk of love or change and things we can't untie. Your eyes are soft with sorrow. Hey, that's no way to say goodbye.
You only write one cigarettes and alcohol in your lifetime, if you're lucky.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems and long forgotten favourites.
Every emotion has a sound to it.
You just gotta do you.
This is Alt 90s on BBC Sounds.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the